footage of a recent performance in Mexico City with virulently anti-Trump images and made clear that both the album and the tour would have significant political overtones. Quote, "Unfortunately, we're all forced to think about current events because we feel the impact of current events. We could go on about your nincompoop president all night. It might be somewhat redundant. He's doing a good job on his own without any of us interfering in his condemnation of himself," unquote. As I listened, I wondered whether Waters worried about his ability to sell seats in red states, and when it came time for audience questions, I stood up and raised the issue. He responded, quote, "You know, just because it's a red state and it's apparently very conservative, Kansas City doesn't mean that there isn't a viable resistance to this administration in that city," unquote. He also noted that he'd be playing a quote-unquote bunch of Pink Floyd songs for which there was great audience attachment, including the song from the legendary Dark Side of the Moon album for which the tour had been named. Quote, "Us and Them from Dark Side of the Moon, you know, with, without, and who'll deny that's what the fighting's all about? You can't get any more contemporary than that. We better start working together cohesively or we're all fucked," unquote. I wrote a Sunday Inquirer column predicting that the tour would be the most politically charged of the summer season. By then, I had reevaluated my treatment of Waters 11 years earlier. I wrote, 5 years post 9/11, I wasn't bothered by the idea of presumed terrorists sitting in Guantanamo Bay without having been charged with a crime. At the end of the Obama administration, 41 men were still held at Gitmo out of the 779 people imprisoned there since 2001. Of the 41, 31 were still being held without charges. That's not right. We're better than the status quo. I ended the column saying, quote, "Sometimes listening to great music means listening to someone whose message makes you uncomfortable," unquote. The column made clear that while I still had political disagreements with Waters, that which separated us had narrowed. And I wasn't finished exploring the outlook of a singer-songwriter whose solo projects and work as the chief lyricist for Pink Floyd I'd been listening to since my teens. I soon made contact with Fran DeFeo, Waters' longtime publicist, and asked to interview Waters for CNN while he was on tour. She was very accommodating and invited me to do so in Miami, where Waters was performing on July 13 at the American Airlines Arena. The plan was for me to interview him at his hotel the night before the show, and then to have a CNN crew shoot some B-roll of me watching Waters do a sound check the night of the show, preferably as he rehearsed with local school kids who would participate in a dance routine during Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2. The afternoon of the interview, we met by happenstance in an otherwise deserted gym at the Mandarin Oriental, where we both were staying. I'd never have known the fit and trim Waters was 73 to see him working out with a trainer and body man. A few hours later, he sat for my 30-minute interview in a hotel room CNN had cleared out for the occasion. I asked whether he was concerned about alienating longtime fans with his virulent anti-Trump message. Quote, "It would be a lot easier to be on tour if I weren't doing any of this, if I didn't have opinions," he said. When I asked him what he might say to someone looking for escapism rather than politics at a rock concert, he was quick with a reply. Quote, "Go see Katy Perry." I was pleased with the interview, and only sorry that because of time constraints, we could not play at all. With commercial breaks, it would have filled the entire hour, which would have suited me just fine, but not CNN. I enjoyed being in his company, and even when we disagreed on subjects like the quote-unquote war on terror, I'm using scare quotes because when I said that phrase, he bristled, I still found him to be civil, bright, passionate, and engaging. I left thinking I could have spoken to him for hours more about politics. Unbeknownst to me, I'd soon get that chance. Twice. The next day, the afternoon of the Miami show, DeFeo told me that the Miami Beach Parks Department had just canceled the participation of its teen club in Waters' show that night. the adults had decided to deny the kids the opportunity to perform a dance routine they'd been rehearsing because the adults had determined that Waters was anti-Semitic, a charge that has long dogged the rock star. The story of the cancellation was quickly gaining steam in the blogosphere. So as I sat watching Waters perform his sound check from the fifth row of an otherwise empty basketball arena that seats 21,000, I suggested to DeFeo and Kate Watkins, who works with Waters' manager, that they allow me to record a brief response to the cancellation on my iPhone that I would post on my Facebook page. After they consulted with Waters, he agreed. By now, the doors to the arena were opening, the show was 90 minutes from starting, and my eldest son had joined me at the venue. The two of us were ushered backstage so that I could ask Waters about the abrupt cancellation of the kids. Sean Evans, Waters' videographer and the director of the extraordinary 2014 documentary The Wall, recorded our conversation. Waters seemed to relish the controversy and was very eager to set the record straight. Peeved is probably the word that best describes his mood. He said that in every city he goes out of his way to recruit kids from disadvantaged backgrounds to perform with him, and that this was the first time there'd been a cancellation. Quote, at 3 this afternoon, one of the local newspapers posted a story saying that these children had backed out of doing the show with me because I'm an anti-Semite and the show is all about hatred, blah, 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 which was a lie. These kids didn't back out of anything. It was the mayor who called the organization, partly funded by the city, and said, your kids cannot perform in the show, unquote. I asked Waters to respond to those who were already complaining to me that I should not be affording him a platform on CNN. Quote, I'm not an anti-Semite, obviously, he said. To call me anti-Semite is malicious propaganda, unquote. The interview went viral. Within days, it racked up nearly a 500,000 views, and the show went on. Somehow, by the time he hit the stage, a little more than an hour later, Waters had recruited another dozen kids who did a fine job performing another Brick Part 2. The show was amazing. People might disagree about the very few numbers that got very political, but no one could dispute the sound and production values. Afterward, I joined the band for what they called the Golden Trough celebration back at the hotel. I was seated at a dinner table next to Waters, and we had a very spirited conversation about U.S. politics and international affairs. The following day, I flew home to Philadelphia, and that Saturday, my interview aired. I didn't hear from Waters or anyone on his team immediately after, and thought he must not have liked his treatment. But the following month, DeFeo contacted me when Waters came to Philadelphia for 3 shows at the Wachovia Center. I had already planned to take my youngest son to the first show. He was 17, a Waters Floyd fan, and this would be his first concert. He loved it. The next day, Mark Fenwick, Waters' manager, called and said that Waters had asked to see me after the second night's performance. I didn't go to that show, but I met him afterward in the bar of La Croix at the Rittenhouse Hotel, which had been closed to all but a handful of the band and support staff. Waters walked in and motioned me to join him at a table for 2. This was not a working meeting. The CNN interview was long over and had already aired. Over my beer and his wine, we had an animated discussion touching on music and politics, with me wanting to talk mostly about the former and him mostly about the latter. By now, I was much more familiar with the new album than I'd been when I first saw him in Miami. I told him that Wait for Her was my favorite song on the new recording. We ended up closing the place. I left only when the bartender flicked the lights. 3 hours later, I got up to deliver my daily radio program and did so without so much as mentioning what I'd done the night before. The Garden of Eternal Vigilance, Philadelphia Daily News, October 5, 2006. It's amazing what neighbors can do when united in purpose. On Saturday in Lower Makefield Township, Bucks County, several thousand gathered in what used to be a nondescript field to rechristen the Garden of Reflection, a tribute to 9/11 victims. Fellow citizens spent 5 years planning and fundraising to bring to life what is now a showpiece for the nation. Bucks was the hardest hit of Pennsylvania's counties on September 11, and Lower Makefield bore a particular brunt because it's a commutable distance to New York City. 17 Bucks Countyans died that day, a statistic that enabled State Representative David Stile to get the Commonwealth to designate the Garden as the official Pennsylvania memorial. From the outset, the Garden was a collaborative effort of neighbors united by tragedy, whose mission seemed guided by divine purpose. How else to explain that on a cold day in January 2002, family survivors Grace Godshalk, Fiona Havlish, Ellen Saracini, and Tara Bain went looking for a site and found a lonely American flag wedged in some bushes on Woodside Road. They knew at once they'd found the spot. 2 years later, Lower Makefield named the proposed site Memorial Park. When it came time to review potential designs, they flowed in from all over, but it was a local woman, Yardley's Luba Lashik, who conceptualized the final plan. The level of her deliberation is readily apparent. Visitors to the garden are first confronted with a several-ton piece of twisted steel from the wreckage of the Twin Towers. This remnant of Ground Zero intentionally faces the direction of New York City. Symbolism is everywhere. 17 maple trees on an outer berm acknowledge the Bucks County residents lost in the attack, and 42 lights along the spiral labyrinth walk remember each of the Pennsylvania children who lost a parent that day. The names of all 2,973 victims are etched in a glass semicircle leading up to the inner sanctum. At the heart of the garden is a reflecting pool where two recessed squares represent the footprint of the Twin Towers and serve as the basis for dual ascending fountains that rise as a metaphor for the soaring spirit of the victims. I'm not a message kind of guy, but even I get the garden. It's a special place worth the drive from anywhere in the region. The dedication befitted the creation. Local firefighters and American flags lined the approach. Valerie Mihalik, a local woman, coordinated the event with military precision. Literally. How else to explain the C-17 that dropped out of the sky and tipped its wing, flown by yet another local, U.S. Air Force Major Samuel Irvin III of Wrightstown? The ceremony was appropriately devoid of politics. Representative Mike Fitzpatrick, in a tough re-election battle, was the MC. His role was deserved, given his procurement of $750,000 to build the garden, but he just did his job and was never formally introduced. It was that kind of low-key day. The speakers were emotional. They included Tara Bain, who lost her 33-year-old husband, Grace Maureen Godshalk, who lost her 35-year-old son, and Ellen Saracini, whose husband Victor was the captain of United Flight 175. The commencement brass played Holy, 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 and the Pensbury High Choir sang You'll Never Walk Alone. We all had goosebumps. Go see the garden. It's just 5 minutes from the New Hope Yardley exit of I-95. When you get there, you will see that the site is ringed with athletic fields where children will play for future generations, which reminds me of the most significant aspect of what these neighbors created. We've all heard it said that with regard to the events preceding that fateful day, the most important failure was one of imagination. Well, sitting at the dedication on Saturday, it occurred to me that for 99% of the country, September 11 was a day never experienced directly. To be sure, we were all witness in a way, and everyone now has images and ideas based on the film footage, but only a few experienced directly the ramifications of what occurred. The garden not only honors the dead, but offers their sacrifice as a way of protecting against any failure of imagination in the future. It's a living reminder of what occurred so that never again will there be a similar lapse of attention. Long after we're gone, the Garden of Reflection will form images and ideas in the minds of those who follow us of a horrific event that will not have been seen or experienced directly by anyone then living. So let's hope that in that way, it will safeguard future generations against a repeat failure of imagination. All of the proceeds from my first book, Flying Blind, How Political Correctness Continues to Compromise Airline Safety Post 9/11, published in 2004, went towards the Garden of Reflection, where I remain an active supporter and benefactor. It's just two turns off of I-95. Make the trip if you've never been. and read more about the garden here, www.9-11memorialgarden.org. Manhunt for Osama dropping on U.S. agenda? Philadelphia Daily News, October 26, 2006. Have the brakes been put on the hunt for Osama bin Laden? Just back from the CENTCOM region, that is my hunch. The effort to find bin Laden was one of the many questions I had about the war on terror as I joined a Pentagon-sponsored military immersion program called the Joint Civilian Orientation Conference. This was to be a unique opportunity for 45 civilians to learn about CENTCOM, a geographical territory encompassing the most dangerous spots in the world, and I was looking forward to being a mental sponge on a subject that has preoccupied me since 9/11. I have done thousands of hours of talk radio and written numerous columns and two books about the war on terror, but never before had I seen it being waged. The week-long activities did not disappoint. The daily agenda was packed and the presenters were stellar. We heard from the defense secretary, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the vice admiral of CENTCOM, and other high-ranking war commanders. Our days began at 5 or 6 a.m. and didn't end until 10 or 11 p.m. We traveled 15,000 miles and spent time in four nations. We ate meals with the soldiers, fired the best of the Army weaponry in the desert, toured classified Air Force surveillance aircraft, and were educated about the latest efforts to counteract the dreaded IEDs, improvised explosive devices. I came home with the utmost of respect for men and women throughout the ranks of all five branches of the service who are committed to eradicating the forces of radical Islam. There was only one area of disappointment. I refer to the hunt for bin Laden and his deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri. I began to think of it as the Lord Voldemort of the trip, which Harry Potter fans will recognize as the individual whose name shall not be uttered. The search for bin Laden and al-Zawahiri was not part of the agenda, and when I did ask questions looking for a status report, there was no information forthcoming except a generic assertion that indeed the hunt continues. For example, when we were briefed at Andrews Air Force Base by Vice Admiral Nichols, the number two to Army General John Abizaid, I asked him whether the hunt for bin Laden was, at this stage, completely dependent upon Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf. He told me we respect national sovereignty and described the search as quote-unquote difficult and nuanced. I took that as a confirmation of my concern about outsourcing. When in Bahrain I put the same question to Marine Brigadier General Anthony Jackson, he told me that the search was the equivalent of finding one man in the Rockies, an analogy that I heard repeatedly from men I met overseas. He also said that, quote, no one is giving up, unquote, and that my question was better put to the guys in special ops. So when we got to the special ops headquarters in Qatar, I raised the matter yet again, this time with Colonel Patrick Pihana, the chief of staff to the Combined Forces Special Operations Component Command. He offered nothing substantive on the issue. There were other places we visited that I am not at liberty to discuss where one would expect it to be a focal point, but it wasn't in our briefings. I want to be clear here. Nowhere did anyone ever tell me that the search for bin Laden is over, but I am worried that the days of aggressively hunting him have ended. I say that based on the lack of response to my repeated questions in the context of other sensitive briefings, the fact that the CIA reportedly closed its bin Laden desk, called the Alec Station, and the agreement reached between Musharraf and tribal leaders in the northwest part of his nation, wherein he has agreed to give them continued free rein. I might be wrong. The prospect certainly exists that the hunt continues and yours truly, a blowhard from Philadelphia, was deemed unworthy of any information. That would be fine with me. I am not one who believes Americans have a right to know secrets, but I would have hoped that along the way, someone would have said so. In light of a great deal of sensitive information that was shared with my group and the total absence of anything about bin Laden, I don't think this is the case. I might be right. To be sure, if we catch a break, I am certain we will grab him and kill him, but maybe our special forces have repositioned their precious resources. And why might this be the case? Well, for starters, because our limited manpower is desperately needed in Iraq. Perhaps they're hiding in Pakistan, and we are respecting their borders, even with the knowledge that Musharraf is limited in what he can or will do to find him. Why would we respect Pakistani borders to the exclusion of finding and killing the most wanted man in the world? Because as weak as Musharraf might be in assisting us in finding bin Laden and al-Zawahiri, he is probably the best we can hope for in Pakistani leadership. Force his hand, and we might lead to his undermining and end up with a friend to radical Islam running the country. There is another consideration. More than one individual with whom I spoke, and no one that I have named here, raised with me the question of what would happen to public support for the war against radical Islam if we were to find and kill bin Laden and al-Zawahiri. Would the American people then expect the military to pack up and go home, they wanted to know from me, who spends 17.5 hours a week answering phone calls from the public? Again, I need to be blunt. No one ever told me that we are not hunting bin Laden because killing him would cause Americans to want to close up shop in Iraq and Afghanistan. But this possible ramification is absolutely on the minds of our warriors as support for the war in Iraq dissipates. I pray my gut is wrong. I hope that somewhere in Pakistan, there are some badass special ops guys wearing veils and burqas, moving through villages, cutting deals, using sophisticated spy gear, and doing whatever is necessary to bring the bastards' lives to the most heinous of endings. Bin Laden and al-Zawahiri are mass murderers responsible for 6,000 deaths, 3,000 on 9/11, and another 3,000 from events tied to that. The search must never end. It would be 6 more years until Osama bin Laden would be killed on Monday, May 2nd, 2011. Like many Americans, I remember exactly where I was when I heard the news. That night, I was at a Neil Young concert at the legendary Tower Theater with my buddy, liberal Paul Lauricella. As we drove home, Twitter began exploding with tidbits of something big having happened. We went back to my house at midnight and watched as President Obama announced the news to the nation. Quote, good evening. Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children. Unquote. I remember going on radio the following day and saying, I wish that I knew who killed him so that I could buy him a beer, prompting several callers to say we would never know the names of the heroes. A few years later, I was able to interview two members of SEAL Team 6 who played critical roles in the mission, Matt Bissonnette, a.k.a. Mark Owen, and Robert O'Neill, the guy who actually killed bin Laden. Both were memorable. I still hope to buy each that beer. Should free speech allow Holocaust denial? Philadelphia Daily News, January 11, 2007. If we really want to know the truth about history, we need to allow freedom of speech. So I was told by David Duke in an interview 3 weeks ago via a scratchy connection from Tehran. He was in Iran to participate in Mohammad Ahmadinejad's Holocaust conference. I follow Duke's career and find his repeated condemnation of Israel and its supporters to be abhorrent. And I knew that accepting an invitation to interview the former Klan Imperial Wizard would cause a stir, but I was willing to speak to him because I was on the verge of visiting the most deadly of all Nazi extermination camps, and I wanted to hear what a self-described revisionist had to say. The fringe represented by Duke argues that laws in Europe prohibiting Holocaust denial inhibit an analysis that could otherwise reveal the Holocaust to be a historical exaggeration that exists to justify the legitimacy of Israel. No Holocaust or exaggerated description? Then there's no justification for the creation of the State of Israel in the minds of these few. Now that I'm back from my visit to Auschwitz, I find that I agree with Duke that Europeans should be free to debate the Holocaust, but not for reasons he would agree with. Having seen the ghastly evidence, I believe it's far easier to defeat the deniers with fact and logic rather than risk fostering the skepticism that comes from making those views illegal. It is through the clash of truth and falsity that the truths of the Holocaust are most readily seen. My trip had been planned for nearly a year. I'm one of a half dozen Philadelphia friends, three Jewish, who regularly travel after New Year's to historic sites. We began in Berlin at the Von See Villa, where on January 20, 1942, 15 officials of the Third Reich plotted the final solution. In their meeting room, we read the protocol written by Adolf Eichmann that set forth the plan to murder European Jews. Then we visited Track 17 in the fashionable Grunewald section of Berlin at the former station that was the point of departure for Jews from the area being sent to the camps. Listed next to the tracks are the dates, number of passengers, and destination of the rail cars. Next stop, the other end of those tracks, in Poland. On a raw, dark, rain-swept day, we spent 4 hours walking the grounds of Auschwitz I and Auschwitz II, Birkenau. We saw it all. At Auschwitz I, we walked through the infamous gate saying, "Work brings freedom." We toured the surviving crematorium. We saw the ghastly displays of human hair, personal effects, suitcases, even shoe polish, all confiscated from the prisoners who'd packed in haste under the ruse of resettlement. Also there, empty canisters that held pellets of Zyklon B, the agent used to exterminate human life in the crematoriums. At Auschwitz II, Birkenau, we stood on the platform where Jews were divided between those who were to be immediately gassed and those who would live for at least a while. We also surveyed the ruins of Crematorium II, the most prolific of the death machines, largely destroyed by the Nazis in an effort to hide their crimes against humanity. The critical question, if the evidence of the Holocaust was right before my eyes, should all argument to the contrary be outlawed? Close to 20 nations say yes and ban Holocaust denial. Austria only recently released historian David Irving, imprisoned for this very crime. Our guide was one of the many who believe those laws justified. She thinks they're a safeguard for properly educating future generations about what occurred. I agree we must ensure the understanding of future generations, but I don't see these laws as a way to do it. Banning Holocaust debate would be like America disallowing argument on the wacky 9/11 internet conspiracy theories. There are many credible-looking websites that have become clearinghouses for rumor and innuendo about the attack on the Pentagon. A missile, some argue, not an airplane. To which I ask, what then happened to American Airlines Flight 77 and its passengers? The most effective way of dealing with such propaganda is to discredit it point by point, not make it unlawful, which runs the risk of fueling skepticism. Popular Mechanics did so exquisitely in both magazine and then book form. It should be the same with Holocaust revisionists. The way to combat their mindset is with total openness and a climate of candor about all aspects of World War II. That includes providing full access even to those locations that run the risk of cultivating morbid curiosity. In Berlin, we stayed in the Hotel Adlon at the foot of the Brandenburg Gate. The concierge provided me with a walking tour map of the neighborhood. Included were both the Reichstag, home of the German parliament, and the memorial for the murdered Jews of Europe. Missing, however, was any reference to what's beneath a nondescript parking lot just 100 yards behind the hotel, Hitler's bunker. Not until the World Cup came to Germany last year was there any sign to note the significance of the spot where Hitler killed himself as Russian troops stormed the Reichstag. That, too, is the wrong response to a hideous chapter of German history. Not only should the location of the bunker be noted, it should be unearthed and open to the public. Those were my views upon arriving back home, but my reflection wasn't over. I then had the chance to question one of the world's foremost historians, Sir Martin Gilbert, official biographer of Winston Churchill and author of Auschwitz and the Allies and The Holocaust, A History of the Jews of Europe During the Second World War. I asked him if he thinks Holocaust denial should be against the law. "This is a very difficult question," he said. He attended almost every day of the trial that convicted David Irving, and quote, "I heard from the mouth of the Holocaust denier the most terrifying racism and anti-Semitism. I thought to myself, if this person is allowed to spread his word to ignorant audiences or audiences who want to be prejudiced, that's a bad thing. So when the Austrian government imprisoned him for his denial, I thought, well, he knew the law, he broke the law, and the Austrians have a right to feel that this is something inflammatory and wrong. I think every country has the right to its own laws. As you say, free speech is tremendously important in our society, and debate and argument, and I'm all for that. I'm all for every Holocaust denier being able to speak in a forum where there's someone who's going to challenge him or her. At the same time, countries like Poland know that Holocaust denial, anti-Semitism, racism take on a life of their own. I told Gilbert that I believe we give credibility to the minute number of deniers by not allowing that kind of dialogue. I worry that there will be a level of skepticism in future generations who will ask why we're able to debate anything but that. I think the key word is dialogue, Gilbert said. I'm totally in favor of every Holocaust denier being able to speak, provided he or she allows there to be a dialogue. I'm willing to travel the world or get up at the crack of dawn in order to be present at such a debate. And many other historians, Jews and non-Jews, will do the same, so that's fine. And the other thing I feel is that Holocaust denial is really quite a minor thing. I mean, it has its fling on the internet. It has its few adherents who travel everywhere, as they did to Ahmadinejad's anti-Holocaust conference. They made a pathetic showing, actually, there. I think that what is important is the amount of material about the Holocaust. Much of that you'd have seen in the Auschwitz bookshop published by Auschwitz itself. Records, diaries, the enormous number of superb memoirs. These are things that are available. They're taught in school. American schools have a very good record mandating Holocaust teaching. I told Gilbert about my Berlin experience and suggested that the Führer bunker be open to the public. He agreed. Quote, when I traveled around Europe with my students about 10 years ago, and I wrote a book about that called Holocaust Journey, I was myself astonished, and I mentioned in the book that there wasn't a plaque there. I'm glad to hear there is, albeit only a small one. There should be complete transparency, and the bunker should be open for the world to see. So let the bunker be open. Let it become a place of pilgrimage, if you like, and a place of learning, as so many Holocaust sites are today. Unquote. Finally, I shared all of this with a close friend who lost family in the Holocaust. We discussed whether free speech should exist on the issue of Holocaust denial. He was unsure, but he acknowledged that laws banning Holocaust denial are probably an insufficient blanket to put out that fire. Early in 2015, there was controversy over whether the third-ranking Republican, House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, the Republican of Louisiana, had once attended a 2002 convention for a white supremacist group, EURO, European American Unity and Rights Organization, that had been founded by David Duke. For a program on January 2, 2015, Duke was invited to be a guest of mine on CNN. My producer told me that Duke would do the show but wanted to be wined and dined, which is how I ended up eating lunch at the bar of the Landmark restaurant in the Time Warner Center with the former Imperial Wizard. What I remember is that he was no different in private than he was in public. Everything he said at lunch came wrapped in his worldview. It was impossible to engage him in a conversation without political overtones. I didn't know it until compiling this book, but he himself recounted the meal on his blog, saying, quote, I actually liked the host personally, found him intelligent and iconoclastic, and immediately understood the depth of his innate rejection for political correctness. I am anxious to read his book on PC. He was kind enough to invite me to a long two-hour lunch after the show. He truly wanted to understand why and what I believe. He asked me so many questions I could barely chew the food. If he had a seven-hour dinner with Fidel Castro, I guess he saw no harm in spending 2 hours with me, unquote. In the CNN interview, Duke said that he didn't recall if Scalise attended the meeting in question. Quote, frankly, I'm not sure. I was in Russia at the time doing research for my dissertation and have since gotten a PhD, unquote. And we had a spirited exchange on camera after I tried to get him to acknowledge the occurrence of the Holocaust. Quote, "I believe in the, quote, Holocaust," unquote, he finally said, his words diminished by adding the air quotes. After the program, my weekly post-show drill was then to get on the subway beneath the Time Warner Center and ride to Penn Station, where I'd catch an Amtrak train back to Philly. On this particular day, I rode the subway solo, got to Penn Station, ate a slice of pizza at a favorite spot downstairs, Rosa's, and then found a seat on my train to Philly. No sooner had I settled in than I saw David Duke walking down the aisle of my train, whereupon he spied me and jumped in the seat like we were long-lost friends. He was as talkative as ever on the train ride, and I was desperately trying to turn the subject away from politics for fear that his comments would be overheard. It's one thing to have a provocative conversation with him in a CNN studio where that's expected, but quite another on a train surrounded by passengers. I remember I asked him what other interests he had and if he liked music. He told me he liked classical music and rattled off a list of German and Austrian composers he thought I should follow. Again, I tried to divert from his worldview, so I asked if he liked classic rock. I volunteered the name of a few classic rock bands on my playlist and with his Southern roots in mind. I said that I was a fan of Leonard Skinner. Another wrong turn. Duke told me a story of having once received a flattering letter from its leader, which I took to mean Ronnie Van Zant, who died in the famous plane crash on October 20, 1977. I have no idea if his claim is true. Only when the doors opened in Philadelphia was I a free bird. Guilty as charged. I don't support Imus's firing. Philadelphia Inquirer, April 15, 2007. Let's get the essentials out of the way. Don Imus said something indefensible. He needed to be punished. The public flogging he has suffered, plus the two-week suspension his bosses initially announced, should have been sufficient. I do not believe that MSNBC, where I often appear, or CBS Radio, my employer, should have fired him. And I cannot fathom how Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson became the arbiters of appropriateness given Tawana Brawley and Hymietown, respectively. Only Imus knows for sure what was on his self-admittedly drug-damaged mind when he said those things. His apology sounded sincere. I myself do not believe he said something racist per se. It was a reach for a cheap laugh, not something said to be injurious to the Rutgers women. Ah, but the floodgates are now open. The cyber lynching by faceless, nameless bloggers of talk show hosts like me has begun. Individuals who hide behind the anonymity afforded by the internet are seeking to squelch the First Amendment rights of people whose identities are readily known and who, unlike their cowardly critics, put their names and credibility on the line each and every day on matters of public concern. Left unconfronted, it is a dangerous practice in the making. The very day Imus was fired at CBS, I was alerted to a posting on Media Matters for America, a sophisticated website instrumental in stoking the flames for Imus's departure. The posting titled, "It's Not Just Imus," identified me as one of seven talk show hosts in America who bear observation. Quote, "As Media Matters for America has extensively documented, bigotry and hate speech targeting, among other characteristics, race, gender, sexual orientation, religion, and ethnicity continue to permeate the airwaves through personalities such as Glenn Beck, Neil Bortz, Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, Michael Savage, Michael Smirkanish, and John Gibson," unquote. I have done talk radio for about 15 years and have written two books, authored hundreds of columns, and have appeared on every major television program in which politics gets discussed, from the Colbert Report to Hardball with Chris Matthews. This week alone, I was responsible for 17.5 hours of content on my own radio show, wrote two newspaper columns, guest-hosted Bill O'Reilly's radio show nationwide, and found time to make television appearances on The Today Show, The Glenn Beck Program, and Scarborough Country. Needless to say, I was anxious to see which of my words among the millions I have offered over all these years have been documented by these blogger watchdogs as quote-unquote bigotry and quote-unquote hate. What exactly puts me in a category with the likes of Michael Savage? Well, let's evaluate the quality of the evidence. For me, they identified three examples. Exhibit A, quote, substituting for host Bill O'Reilly on the April 4, 2006 broadcast of Westwood One's The Radio Factor, nationally syndicated radio host Michael Smirkanish repeatedly discussed the sissification of America, claiming that political correctness has made the United States a nation of sissies. Smirkanish also claimed several times that this sissification and limp-wristedness is compromising our ability to win the war on terror, unquote. Guilty as charged. America is getting muzzled. Those among us who assert their own brand of political correctness while sacrificing the rugged individualism that has been the hallmark of our nation are seeking to mute the words and actions of others, make them conform to a standard of correctness that is not just silly, but also toxic. In the past, this sanitization of that which we say and do would have been debate-worthy, but, in truth, only a minor irritant to our quality of life. But I believe that in a post-9/11 world, these trends represent a cancer that is metastasized into the war on terror, where it threatens our very survival. We debate the comfort level at Gitmo while Nick Berg gets decapitated. We've become sissies in that regard. Exhibit B, quote, on the November 23rd, 2005 broadcast of The Radio Factor, while guest hosting, Smirkanish took issue with a decision by the New Jersey Sports and Exposition Authority to provide a designated prayer area at Giants Stadium. The decision was in response to a September 19 incident involving the FBI's detention and questioning of five Muslim men who were observed praying near the stadium's main air duct during a New York Giants football game. Smirkanish stated, I just think that the men's public praying is wrong. I just think they're playing a game of, you know, mind blank with the audience, and that they should know better 4 years removed from September 11, unquote. Guilty. When five Muslim men in attendance at the Meadowlands in September 2005 for a Giants-Saints game that was also a Hurricane Katrina fundraiser with George Herbert Walker Bush in attendance saw fit to pray in an area near food preparation and air duct work, I think it was a case of mind blank. That's a form of terrorism in itself. Exhibit C, quote, on the November 23rd, 2005 edition of The Radio Factor, Smirkanish interviewed Soo Kim Abood, author of Top of the Class, How Asian Parents Raise High Achievers and You Can Too. Smirkanish asserted that if everyone follows Dr. Abood's prescription, you're going to have women who will leave the home and now get a great paying job because you will have gotten them well educated. He continued, but then they're not going to be around to instill these lessons in their kids. In other words, it occurs to me that perhaps you've provided a prescription to bring this great success to an end, unquote. My favorite, and truly an assertion that shows how asinine this situation has quickly become. Guilty. Two Philadelphia area Asian sisters wrote a great book explaining the success of their upbringing. The bottom line was their parents' hands-on approach. I not only hosted them on air, but also honored them at a book club meeting with several hundred attendees. It occurred to me that if their advice were followed, it would create more high achievers with better educational opportunities and job offers, which would, ironically, take them out of the home where they could instill those same values to their own children. But now, that insight is sexist. How long before they start burning my tapes? Here's a head-scratcher. Immediately after I wrote this column critical of Don Imus but arguing that he should not have been fired, MSNBC invited me to sit in his chair and anchor his old program. How could they not have known I'd taken this position? Or did they not care? Or did they figure it out after inviting me? I still don't know. I ended up spending a week guest hosting the old Ima show. As I wrote in my book Morning Drive, quote, instead of getting up at 3:15 a.m. to do Morning Drive in Philly, I got up at 2 a.m. to do Morning Drive in Philly, simulcast to everyone else, from the MSNBC studio in Secaucus, New Jersey, unquote. The week went well, but MSNBC ultimately gave Ima's spot to Joe Scarborough, for whom I had often guest-hosted at 10 p.m., who was my last guest while I was temporarily in that slot. My producer, TC, really helped engineer quite a national television debut of my radio show. Other guests of mine that week included Rudy Giuliani, Camille Paglia, Richard Clark, Pat Buchanan, John McCain, D.L. Hughley, Larry Kane, and John Anderson from Yes. Anderson closed the Tuesday show by singing Roundabout, after which it was announced on set that Steve Kappas, the president of NBC News, was on the telephone. I momentarily thought he was calling to congratulate me on a quality program. Actually, he was calling for John because he, too, is an Uber Yes fan. For my Sunday Inquirer column that immediately followed my week filling Ima's old spot, I published a diary of what my crazy week had entailed and then wrote, quote, camera lights go dark and mic cut. 5 days over, no glitches, no gaffes, time to slide off the national stage and head back to the place where I've been content for all of my 45 years, unquote. Not long thereafter, I began guest hosting Hardball for Chris Matthews on MSNBC, a role I then consistently played for 5 years. Finally, in 2014, CNN gave me my own television program. The War Comes Home, Philadelphia Daily News, May 10, 2007. Things like this don't happen here. That's what I was thinking while standing at a parking lot at State and Hamilton in Doylestown last week. It's a location I know well. I used to walk through this spot most mornings on the way to high school at CB West when the school was known for being a football powerhouse. Across the street is my mother's real estate office. Catty Corner is La Maison Cheese Shop, where I often stop for a bite. Down the block is Kenny's News Agency, where we used to line up for Spectrum concert tickets. Still visible in the distance is where Burt's Bicycle Shop once sold my parents my banana seat bike. 2 blocks away is the County Theater. I remember the night in the 1970s when Kevin Benstead streaked after the Bad News Bears let out. Main Street merchants, high school hijinks, that's the normal stuff of Doylestown, not what I witnessed on Friday night. Ladder 79 of the Doylestown Fire Company raised an American flag above a crowd of a few hundred. And as the clock, a gift from the Rotary Club marking Doylestown's founding in 1838, was about to strike 8, someone called for a moment of silence. In front of the crowd was a fit, immaculately groomed man wearing a blue Oxford shirt. He was on the verge of tears. His wife, in black, was already over that line. Equally distraught was their daughter and son-in-law. No one could blame them or understand their loss. They were Colonel Thomas Mannion, Janet Mannion, Ryan Borick, and David Borick, the family of Travis Mannion. The night was supposed to be First Friday in Doylestown, a monthly ritual for dining out and shopping, but the evening had been recast as a vigil for Marine First Lieutenant Travis Mannion, who died in Iraq on April 29. But by the time it began, its purpose had changed yet again. Now, it wasn't just to honor Mannion, but also another man from town as well, Army First Lieutenant Colby Umbrell, who died May 3rd. Neither fit the cliche of who's fighting in Iraq. They were 26, scholars, athletes, warriors, patriots, and from Doylestown. Young men who could have done anything with their lives. Now, there were 2 condolence books to sign, and silently, the crowd did so. As we waited, a young woman named Christy Jefferson sang Amazing Grace. Major Adam Kubicki is the commanding officer of Military Transition Team 20. He was Travis Mannion's commanding officer and was at his side when he died. He wrote a letter to the family, which they shared with me. Major Kubicki wrote, "Know that Travis meant a great deal to all of us in his unit. He was an incredible officer, a true warrior, and an example and inspiration to us all. He was also an honorable man willing to pursue the right path no matter the difficulty. His enthusiasm and abilities were apparent to everyone, including the Iraqis with whom he lived and served. Meanwhile, an Associated Press story ran in this newspaper on May 1 under the headline, April's Toll, 104 Troops. It's the sort of story that I would have read in passing. I doubt I would have paused when I got to the paragraph that said, a Marine died in combat Sunday in Anbar province, a Sunni insurgent stronghold west of the capital, the military said. But the Marine who died in Anbar was Travis Mannion. And when another story is written giving the final count for May, there will be one more Doylestonian in those ranks, Lieutenant Umbrell. It's difficult to localize a war fought around the globe when daily stories describe a death toll pushed upward by often faceless, nameless soldiers killed in combat. But things have changed. Never again will I read a headline on war dead and see only words. The war has now come home. Five years later, tragedy revisited the Mannions when Travis's mother, Janet, passed away from lung cancer. But by then, she'd assured the legacy of her son by establishing the Travis Mannion Foundation, TMF, which continues to thrive. As described on the foundation's website, travismannion.org, quote, Travis's legacy lives on in the words he spoke before leaving for his final deployment. If not me, then who? Guided by this mantra, veterans continue their service, develop strong relationships with their communities, and thrive in their post-military lives. As a result, communities prosper and the character of our nation's heroes live on in the next generation, unquote. In 2014, Travis's father, Tom, teamed up with journalist Tom Saleo to write the book Brothers Forever, telling the story of Travis and his Naval Academy roommate and best friend, Lieutenant Brendan Looney, who died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. Together, theirs is a sad and amazing story, and one that I have also written about. The two men are buried beside one another at Arlington National Cemetery. Brendan Looney's widow, Amy, opened the second of the Travis Mannion Foundation's four offices in San Diego shortly after his death in 2010. And on Memorial Day in 2011, President Obama visited the graves of Lieutenants Mannion and Looney and told their story during his address at the Arlington National Cemetery. Quote, the friendship between First Lieutenant Travis Mannion and Lieutenant Brendan Looney reflects the meaning of Memorial Day, brotherhood, sacrifice, love of country. And it is my fervent prayer that we may honor the memory of the fallen by living out those ideals every day of our lives in the military and beyond, unquote. Unexpected Memorial Day lesson from decorated Marine. Philadelphia Inquirer, May 27, 2007. I thought I had a great idea for a Memorial Day weekend column. I believe that the men currently fighting in Iraq are an unheralded bunch, no less deserving of our thanks and praise than those of the so-called greatest generation who fought World War II. My plan was to contact some of the highest profiles of that generation and see whether they agreed. I had in mind men like Bob Dole, who as a member of the Army's 10th Mountain Division tried to rescue one of his platoon's radio men while fighting in the hills of Italy and almost paid with his life, or Wild Bill Guinier of Easy Company, a D-Day hero immortalized by historian Stephen Ambrose in his book Band of Brothers. I hoped they'd share a few stories, praise fellow soldiers, and offer a word of remembrance. That was the plan, except I never got past the first interview. I started and ended with Jack Lucas. Lucas became known to me when I visited the USS Iwo Jima last October while she sailed in the Persian Gulf. I was a military tourist, and on landing aboard ship by helicopter, I found myself on what's called the Jack Lucas Airfield. Naturally, I inquired, who is or was Jack Lucas? Well, shame on me for not knowing his story. Jack Lucas remains the youngest recipient of the Medal of Honor since the Civil War. Today he is 79, but he was recognized for his conduct at age 17. Lucas finagled his way into the Marines when he was just 14 by forging his mother's signature on the consent papers. 6 days after his 17th birthday, he threw himself on top of two grenades to save three fellow Marines. He was one of 22 Marines to receive the Medal of Honor for service at Iwo Jima. Quote, "I was fortunate that one was a dud. The other tore me up pretty bad, but I survived it, and so did the three men who were with me, and they enjoyed a full life," unquote, he told me this past week. When the war ended and his body had healed, Lucas kept a promise made to his mother upon enlistment. He returned to high school, ninth grade, now sporting a Medal of Honor and driving an Oldsmobile convertible, all of which is column-worthy in itself. But things got even more interesting when I said to him, quote, "You know, Mr. Lucas, we think of you as a member of the greatest generation, and as I become more familiar with the gentlemen who have given their lives in the war in Iraq, I believe that they, too, are a great generation," unquote. As expected, Jack Lucas agreed with me. But then he offered a 10-minute discourse on Iraq, which was not what I had expected from this larger-than-life Marine. He began by reminding me that in the Second World War, 400,000 young men lost their lives and an additional 900,000 were wounded. He thought that was a horrible price to pay, but necessary because we'd been attacked. Vietnam and Korea, by contrast, were wars that were, quote, "really not necessary," unquote, but were, quote, "brought upon us by politicians who thought we needed to go to war. We were not attacked. Each life given for America is most valuable and most precious, and I do not want to put that down. But for comparison, consider the viciousness of World War II. We lost 5,320 men in the first 2 days of combat at Iwo Jima, and in just 36 days, 6,820 men killed at Iwo Jima and 19,000 wounded. Just 36 days. In Iraq, we are going on 5 years and lost 3,300 men and 25,000 wounded. So you see the difference in the violence of the war," unquote. On Iraq, Jack Lucas was just getting started. He recognized that Saddam Hussein was a dictator, albeit not one who attacked us and who possessed no weapons of mass destruction. Quote, "We have gone in and caused our young men to lose their lives. Our men are very precious, and we don't need to be losing lives for something we should not be in the first place, Iraq," unquote. Lucas bristled at the notion that Iran may be a future point of conflict and argued that if we'd kept Saddam Hussein in power, he'd be dealing with Iran and we wouldn't have to. He told me about a trip that he'd taken to Bethesda Naval Hospital, where he saw young men with no arms and legs. Quote, "It makes me sick," unquote. He deemed it, quote-unquote, heartbreaking and, quote-unquote, unnecessary. Quote, "We should have gone into Afghanistan with sufficient troops and got bin Laden and wiped out al-Qaeda and crushed the Taliban," unquote, he said, before finally pausing to catch his breath. And when he did so, I remembered the initial purpose of my call. "Mr. Lucas," I said, "do you agree that the service of these men is no less noble than your own?" Quote, "You got that exactly right," unquote, he said with authority. Quote, "And I do not want to equate it otherwise. Everyone who serves this great nation, in peacetime as well as wartime, are our most noble young people. And we do cherish them, and we want to look out for our young men. And when we want to get them out of harm's way, people want to call us, quote-unquote, liberal or, quote-unquote, panty waste. And I ain't never been no panty waste, but I want my boys out of Iraq," unquote. Lucas's message for Memorial Day? Quote, "Just remember all of the young people who lost their lives in this great country, everybody, and bow your heads and think about them and inscribe their names on your hearts," unquote. All the while Lucas spoke, I was thinking of a friend who told me that wars are fought by people who are infinitely wiser and braver than the people who start them. Jack Lucas died of leukemia in 2008 at age 80. His obituary in the New York Times said, quote, "Big for his age and eager to serve, he forged his mother's signature on an enlistment waiver that would have allowed him to join the Marines at 17 rather than the usual 18. But in fact, he was by then only 14, though the military did not learn of that until censors discovered it through a letter he had written to his 15-year-old girlfriend, unquote. I didn't know that part about the girlfriend, or I surely would have written it myself, but I'm glad I did describe the image of Lucas returning to the ninth grade wearing a Medal of Honor and driving an Oldsmobile.